Some of the stories I've heard are crazy, where a founder had enough money to pay for AWS that month or to have a tooth extracted. He had to go to the dentist. He chose to drink a lot of whiskey and had a friend pull it out for him, to the point of going, he'd rather keep the service running and sacrifice his personal well-being. It's outrageous.
Let's hear your answer about an eternal debate on, oh, Africa is 4 years behind LATAM. Some people say, oh, that's totally not true. We're 10 years behind. And some people say we're 20 years behind. We've been doing deals in LATAM and Africa.
Yeah.
In your view, what's the number of years
of difference?
Of difference, yeah.
When it comes to multi-country operations, does it create complexity for what an exit could look like? So let's say you're in Nigeria, Brazil, and Philippines. Unless it's an IPO, who's going to buy you?
Yeah.
How many companies have a strategic interest in those three? Fintech 1.0 was pure play products. Fintech 2.0 became marketplaces of going, what if you asset light and we'll find distribution partners? 3.0, I think, is where we are now, where you are building infrastructure layers to allow everyone to use it.
Hello, Internet, and welcome to the fourth episode of the Relicap podcast. My name is Kian, and I'm a partner at Relicap. Today's guest is Johan Bossini, partner at Kona Capital. Kona is the OG of emerging market fintech. Since inception, they raised over $800 million to invest with a very specific focus. They only invest at Series A, only in emerging markets, and only in fintech inclusion. Their portfolio includes Creditas, the Brazilian lending giant, IndiaMART, who IPO'd in 2019, Yoko, one of my favorite South African companies, and then Klar in Mexico, who got valued at $500 million. At Relicap, we always had an admiration for Kona Capital, sometimes calling ourselves the pre-seed Kona. And this conversation with Johan further confirmed our alignment in ethos, mindset, and approach to investing. Kona is really one of the few firms out there who truly understands the nuances of investing across LATAM, Africa, and Asia. So without further ado, let's get into it. Johan, thanks for doing this.
Sure,
no. Welcome to the kitchen. This is going to be fun. Cool. How big is Kona today?
Sure.
How many funds did you raise so far? Where are you in the deployment of this current fund?
So Kona, we're on fund three at the moment. We raised fund one in 2016, which is $142 million, fully deployed now. Fund two was a total of $204 million. Fund three, we're deploying out of now, $332 million, and then an opportunity fund. And then really the opportunity fund, we call it the best of Kona. And that's a handful of companies out of fund one, two, and three that we can invest in. We are still investing out of fund three. We still have a number of deals we can do. It's great to have liquidity in this current market and still investing, still looking at deals. Quickly, in terms of Kona, we are a very narrow fund where we only do fintech, we only do financial inclusion, we only do emerging markets, and typically only do Series A. Having said that, it allows us to make decisions quickly around this pattern recognition of financial inclusion in emerging markets, leaning on each other in different regions. The team is quite deliberately placed across the globe, so Latin America, Africa, MENA, Asia team. That was a decision we made around having people on the ground in our markets, speak the language, went to school there, and just having those networks that you can really draw on, and that ability to then move quickly and learn from each other across different regions.
What's fun about your job?
What's fun? Yeah, it's interesting. Before I joined Kona, I wasn't in the investment world. And it was a change of gears, really. You're a little bit on the outside. And it was, I'll be honest, pretty lonely at first, where you have influence, you don't have control. And one of my colleagues said to me after about a year, he said, think about it this way. You get to spend time with 20, 30, 40, 50 amazing businesses rather than just being in one. That was a real penny dropping moment for me where I sat there going, I get to engage with incredible people in amazing countries, really building meaningful businesses and driving real impact. And I'd say that, how can that not be fun? In addition to that, I think what's been amazing for me is this community has evolved dramatically in the last 7 years. If you look at even the conferences we spoke about earlier over the last couple of weeks, it's almost like a reunion of sorts where you see people you haven't seen in ages.
Yeah.
And I think that you only get better at being able to then invest because you start getting a good sense of who's doing what do they enjoy investing in, what are they good at investing in. And it gives you that ability of drawing on a far broader ecosystem, which has been a lot of fun.
I'm curious, how do you assess yourself over the years and say, Johan, I'm better now. I probably have a blind spot. I have to work on it. Do you have a system for yourself?
That's a great question. I think to a certain extent, many people in this industry at some point have imposter syndrome. And maybe it's just me, maybe it's not everyone else. Where it is a difficult job. If I reflect back on the last 7 years, a couple of things stand out. One was this incredibly long feedback loop. You think you're doing a good job, you've made a good investment, they raise follow-on capital, the numbers are looking good, but you don't really know until there's an exit, which can be 10 years down the line. So you're always second-guessing yourself. Your question is a good one. I think it's around the validation you're getting from the industry around when people continue to come back to you, either co-investors reaching out saying, looking at a great deal, do you guys want to look at it with us? And that doesn't happen if people don't see value in you. I've enjoyed that validation of suddenly having a lot more interest from co-investors, from founders who reach out saying, I've got this great friend who's launching an amazing business. Would you like to meet them, or can I introduce you? And I think those feedback loops are validating in itself, where, again, great founders choose investors.
On your strategy, you mentioned financial inclusion across emerging markets. When you pitch RallyCap, sometimes you say with a pre-seed corner, just because it's easier to explain that it's fintech, emerging market, and pre-seed. I would ask you the same questions that we're always asked at RallyCap, which is, how do you think differently when deploying in LATAM versus Africa? Do you have some different mental models, or do you use the same lens everywhere?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's been a conversation internally for a while. We have the same requirement regardless of location. What I mean by that is, we don't have what's good for one region, we have what's good for Kona. We make decisions at a fund level, and I think that's a good outcome for LPs. And it's hard at times. Comparing a deal you're looking at in Kenya to Brazil, obviously fundamentally different regions, and it's not just market size, but it's the maturity of the ecosystem, the evidence of downstream capital, of exits, competition, etc., etc. It's a difficult point of comparison. The nice thing there is it just means we have to work a lot harder and just really think of where are the really good deals by region and compare them to other geographies. What it's given us, though, is a competitive advantage where a lot of founders will look at us and say, we really like the fact that you have got similar type of businesses, obviously nuances to them, in different regions that we get to learn from. We've set up a bunch of conversations between founders, and it's amazing seeing the organic conversation that happens thereafter. Where, for example, we have a leadership summit once every 18 months. We get all our founders together somewhere in the world. And WhatsApp groups have evolved that we aren't on. But it's founders discussing between themselves, going, we're all in the SME finance space. And these guys will get together and these teams will start discussing everything from fundraising, strategy, debt raising, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they see the value in the fact that we work with such different geographies. But the similarities in these businesses are also really high, in the sense that a lending business, you're going to have the same challenges. Different nuances, but I'd say there's like almost like 80% similarity depending on the model.
I'm loving this conversation because you're basically preaching RallyCap.
Well, it's the same as you guys,
right? It's exactly what we tell LPs. But exactly the same.
And actually, I'll turn around at you though, because you guys are a small team, right? Yeah. And you guys cover even, if you think of it by at an individual level, you guys cover even more ground. How have you guys managed it? And have you found that there's a silver bullet, or do you?
For us, it's the community-led investing approach, right? Because Hayden is in SF, I'm in Tunis, Grisha is in Lagos, we definitely cannot see everything and hear everything.
Yeah.
But then we have this network of 15 plus venture partners who are incentivized with carry. And also we have this massive Slack community of 200 people who are deep into fintech now climate. When there's 200 people on the ground, everyone knows someone who's leaving to start something new, sends it to us. So we're usually able to see those deals at idea stage. And because every community member is a micro LP into the fund, they have skin in the game and properly incentivized to make the portfolio work.
Your Slack channels must be, when you wake up in the morning,
insane.
It must be an hour to catch up.
Yeah, at some point it's been a big part of daily cleaning up stuff and notifications and managing. Now I think the Slack is being self-managed, but at some point, they needed community managers and that was a lot of work. So when you mentioned nuances in some business models elsewhere, we definitely happens the same to us, where we do a deep dive into a model, we really like it, we make the investment, and then we're like, okay, who's the strongest team who's building on this model somewhere else?
Yeah.
Do you have some examples about how you learned about those nuances and how that same model doesn't apply the same way in Brazil than in Kenya, for example?
Yeah, it's interesting looking at the African founders, many of which have felt compelled they need to launch in a new market really quickly. Right. And the reason is we have a hyper-fragmented reality in Africa in comparison to a very large market in, let's say, Brazil or India or Indonesia, etc. I think competition is a big one, and especially well-funded venture firms. It was interesting, the other day I was chatting to someone around what kills great businesses. And very often it's very well-funded venture firms who are competing in the same market, where you have venture dollars to really just undercut everyone and buy the market. And at some point, reality kicks in where you simply have to start charging a fair fee that gives you a business that generates revenue and eventually gets to sustainability.
Are we talking about agency banking in Nigeria?
That's definitely one of them, absolutely. And I think there are a few categories, actually, where you've had a great storyline, very often predicated on the success of a very large market where someone raised a huge amount of money and eventually became a unicorn. And everyone says, that's the Uber of this or the Uber of that. And it's the same here, where you just have actually probably pretty good businesses. And if they weren't a huge number of competitors who are very well funded, they might have actually worked.
You're also referring to the B2B supply chain side and
everyone
trying to be the Udan. On another episode, we had Enrique from Speedinvest.
Oh, right.
They invested in ShopUp in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
He said the reason they invested in that B2B supply chain in Bangladesh is because every time they look at the deal in Africa, there are four competitors. And ShopUp was the only one in Bangladesh. That's how you grab a market. You have to be alone or at least have one competitor, but not five.
Yeah, exactly. I think if you look at some markets, there's been just a hyper-competitive environment, which is difficult. In others, and I remember it was in Francophone Africa, you often see these companies where you go, it might not be, you know, each individual market in Francophone Africa isn't enormous. Combined, it could be big enough to be something really interesting. Obviously, you have the complexity of still multi-country operations, but you have some similarities more so than others, but no competition. So you do look at it and think, hang on a second, maybe this isn't a bad idea, right? Someone has space to go and grow in. They don't need as much money because they're not competing against the others. Where I think Nigeria has seen quite a few categories that have just been, I wouldn't say indexed by one fund, but multiple funds putting money into competitors. Yep. And that isn't very helpful for anyone, really.
Totally agree. So last question on drawing parallels between LATAM and Africa.
Yeah.
Let's hear your answer about an eternal debate on, oh, Africa is 4 years behind LATAM. We're going to be the next LATAM for years. Some people say, oh, that's totally not true. We're 10 years behind. And some people say we're 20 years behind. You're an emerging market investor and you've been doing deals in LATAM and Africa.
Yeah.
In your view, what's the number of years
of difference?
Yeah.
I think many of these predictions don't age well, but I'll try anyway. I think it's about 7 years is my guess. If I look back 7 years when I joined Krona and I look at where Latin America was then, it was still emerging as an ecosystem. You now have evidence of, and you began to see evidence of exits, and it accelerates really quickly. The second you start having some IPOs and some strategic exits, I think it accelerates incredibly fast from there. It's a pity that we've had this financial downturn because we began seeing that. We started seeing some really interesting exits, whether it be strategic buyouts, so Network International buying DPO, or large checks going into a variety of payments companies, one being Yoko, Interswitch, Flutterwave, Fari. So you had all these really interesting dynamics where if we didn't have a slowdown, I think we would have continued to see a huge amount of interest from strategic acquirers and potential IPOs as well. I think we're about 7 years behind. I still am very encouraged by some of the companies out there that I think will do really well. This coming year, I think, is going to be slow in the first half, and it will start improving thereafter. Let's see how well this ages. But the one challenge we have is each country in isolation is not as big as Brazil or Mexico. Within this fragmentation, the narrative has been, are these markets too small individually? Mm. Having said that, there are companies out there in certain markets, and you know, obviously know George from Rubber Capital. He talks about this business in Kazakhstan where there are 19 million people, and I think it was a 1.4 billion revenue reality. So it highlights there are times where you just go super deep in one market, like really deep. Don't get distracted by the storyline of you need to be a multi-country operation in order to raise more capital. It is tempting. The narrative for a while was you're only in South Africa, you need to be somewhere else, or you're only in Ghana, you need to move into Nigeria. I still think people underestimate the complexity of multi-country operations in many ways. It's exponentially more complicated. So it is going to be interesting to see which one holds true. Do you go broader or do you just go a lot deeper? Right now, I'm leaning on go deep in your market.
Worse when it's cross-continental, because I hear it from some African founders who want to go to LATAM. Do you know what it implies?
And we see it really often, right? We've seen quite a lot have moved into Asia, into Latin America, into Eastern Europe at times. It creates complexity. And the one thing that actually love your view on exits, where you guys are earlier stage, but we play in the same space in many ways. When it comes to multi-country operations, does it create complexity for what an exit could look like? So let's say you're in Nigeria, Brazil, and Philippines. Unless it's an IPO, who's going to buy you?
Yeah.
How many companies have a strategic interest in those three combined? Have you guys seen any of that?
Yeah, we advise some of our portfolio companies who have satellite operations to say, hey, this is not appealing even to Series A investors, because if you're going after the Kwana, Novastar, Norsken, Afrikainvest, Partech, you don't have many choices. It's these six investors and they all have a vested interest in Africa. But then if you have a satellite outside, it might not.
It's off mandate because suddenly you're in a country that they're in focus on, right?
Since you have such narrow industry focus on fintech with a large geographic scope, I'm guessing you cannot afford to just react to your deal flow and try to see which deals you want to do. You really have to be thesis driven by the force of how the fund is designed. The same with Relica. How do you build your own thesis on which opportunities do you want to go after?
Sure.
Do you create a list of models you like? And how do you do from saying, we have these five spaces we want to go to, and now let's speak to every single team who's been...
Yeah.
Is this how it works?
Yes and no. I think inevitably in an ecosystem, to remain relevant and stay connected, when things come your way, you need to at least engage and understand what they're doing. In terms of being thesis-driven, absolutely. If I look at fintech overall, I think around there are three stages over time. One was fintech 1.0. This is not in a book classifying the different stages of fintech, but it's more just simplistically, fintech 1.0 was pure play products. You're a lending app and credit wasn't available in that country and you were relevant as you launched. The second stage was kind of fintech 2.0 became marketplaces of going, well, what if you asset light? What if you just enable the ecosystem by saying we will work with banks using the lending example and we'll find distribution partners. 3.0, I think, is where we are now, where we're seeing a lot more evidence of financial infrastructure, which is relevant to us, obviously, as a financial inclusion-focused fund, where you are building infrastructure layers to allow everyone to use it. That could be open banking, it could be AI to a certain extent, lending as a service, etc. I think this last category to me becomes really interesting because you are really building a business where the rails, doesn't matter who uses it. If you have 50 players in the market and 25 use it, you build a meaningful business. Doesn't matter which 25. Versus backing another lender where it's a hyper-competitive market. The barrier to entry as well for pure play products is just much easier. If you'd like to lend, you can in theory do it off Excel. I'm not saying anyone does, but you could. So I think for us, we've really been tracking the third category a lot more to say, let's find companies like this and speak to everyone, understand where the opportunities are, and then learn about what's happened in other geographies around how these companies have progressed, where the challenges are. And it's interesting what happens when you talk to a founder and say, we have seen that these will be the challenges in the future. It builds a lot more trust that it's not just capital. You actually really can be there to help them build their business.
100%. In Africa, you did Yoko on the acceptance science at POS and Core Codes. You've done Khazna, the early wage access. Mm-hmm. You did Verto on the B2B transfers.
Yep.
You did Sava on the corporate spend. Once you cover so many spaces, how do you keep being inspired for the next thing? Is there a next thing? For example, when you're planning 2024, what is yet to be invested in?
Right. Look, the iteration we've seen just continues. We'll pursue a business opportunity even if the market or conventional wisdom says this is not going to work. And it's where people see an opportunity to reinvent a category. What we see next, to be honest, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like. But I do think that if we look at where we are right now, there is definitely, within this FinTech 3.0 category I mentioned, a lot more of a synergistic approach of enabling everyone in the ecosystem. Rather than challenging the banks and trying to kill them, or the insurance companies, or the traditional payments companies, how do we enable them? How do we build technology where the regulators like the story as well, of just going, you have a license and a balance sheet. And I've said this for a while around, many FinTech players want to work with the bank, for example, because they have the license and the balance sheet. To get the license and build a balance sheet as a startup is really hard. On the other side, the incumbents look at many of these fintech startups and go, we want what you have, which is technology and people breaking convention and the ability to move quickly and the ability to hire great people. Phenomenal developers, engineers, or data scientists want to focus on meaningful work.
Understood. I think the last deal we did together was Sava.
Yep.
Why did you decide to make that deal? Yeah. What was the thesis and why do you think it's a compelling company?
Sure. It comes down to a few things. And it's amazing how, if I reflect back, and actually this is maybe a longer conversation around, sometimes you see a company and it just, from the first 20 minutes, you go, this is something we really want to do. And I think it comes down to number one, team. I like the fact that they are so different and they bring different skills to the table. Number two was a syndicate who came together really quickly. A lot of comfort in the people around the table who I think have skills and answers and networks that we don't necessarily have. I think the expense management space is also an interesting one, whether you call it the BRICS of Africa. In South Africa, it doesn't really exist. So again, if you look at the SME category, there are many problems to be solved. Yoko started, as we know, very much like the other players in that space, as merchant acceptance. You're a small business, you're not accepting cards, and now you can. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Help me get paid more as a business. Then you have someone like Lula and all the others in that category as well, and there are quite a few of them, where they were saying, we're helping with working capital. That's the point of entry. We're helping you with the ability to have cash flow when you need it to help you grow your business. And then someone like Saba came along saying, we're not going to solve either of those problems. We're going to help you with your expense management. And it's really around just creating transparency and managing and putting controls in place that of your, choose a number, 25 staff, we can give you the ability to control how much they're spending. So don't focus on making more money necessarily, but focus on actually controlling your spend. These are all individual problems that small businesses have. What's going to be interesting is to see how all of those categories evolve in terms of, do they go again just a lot deeper in their space and become just far better either lenders or merchant acceptance or expense management, or do they begin to collaborate, where we're seeing that already, there is some collaboration happening between them, or do they begin to compete and actually start going broader and saying, what if we do that as well and have margin expansion? So for us, really, with Sava, it was one of, it's a proven category in terms of global players, but hadn't really been done in South Africa or in other markets in Africa for that matter either. There have been evidence of some, but we hadn't seen anyone really succeed. So we thought that combination of factors, really liked the deal.
Cool. And it's early days, fingers crossed.
Exactly.
There'll be another company worth mentioning because we missed it. We spoke to the company pre-pivot, Star Kitchens.
Yep.
It was a network of dark kitchens, basically. Yep. They pivoted and it became Orda. I'm hearing the numbers are insane. You're a financial inclusion investor. How do you look at Orda and a restaurant ordering platform within your lenses? And how does a toast for Nigeria make sense?
It's a category I didn't fully understand until we looked into the detail, where if you look at the disposable income for someone in Nigeria or Kenya, the amount that they spend on food every single day is significant. I forget the actual number here, but it's somewhere around 50%. In many of these markets, hyperlocal retail, which means it's a finite number of people going to a very small number of restaurants and getting food every single day. These are all pen and paper type of operations, extremely inefficient. Star Kitchens or Order Now came in with a point of sale terminal that did a few things. Number one was, we'll help you organize your business, taking orders, inventory management. And over time, you can then progress to taking payments, which is what they're doing now. And on top of that was then plugging small restaurants into delivery apps. From the terminal, you can start receiving an order from a delivery app and then having someone collect the food and deliver it. You're actually immediately overnight expanding someone's audience, where it was just footfall coming into their restaurant. And now suddenly it's a whole audience of delivery, which never existed in the beginning. I know a few companies have tried it, but I think here what was interesting was going deep in a specific segment, which is small scale restaurants. Yeah. When you do that and you build technology that appeals to and resonates with the restaurant owner, it's a no-brainer, right? Someone looks at it saying, you understand my business. It's not just a generic ledger ordering platform or a kind of digitization platform where I can organize myself. It's something which talks to me in my process. The reason I get excited with businesses like that is it fits very nicely into this embedded finance theme where you solve a bigger problem in the beginning, which in this case is creating transparency and digitizing a restaurant that was using pen and paper. You're now building rich insights into the business. Number one, you can see how much they are turning over on a daily basis. You then start building trust where suddenly someone uses this device on a daily basis. The natural extension there is to say, we now have information on you, we have working capital. The next will be payments, which has now been implemented. I was accepting cash only, now I can accept digital payments. And they all start feeding each other because the more digital payments I take, the more credit I can access over time. Suddenly it becomes this ecosystem, which becomes incredibly interesting. As a small business, once you're using a platform like that and you're using multiple products, your willingness to churn to someone else is drastically reduced because now this becomes your restaurant operating system, which you rely on a daily basis as your income.
Fascinating race to watch. Is there any business models that you saw in LATAM or Asia and say, hey, I wish someone was building this in Africa?
Yeah, the one which I guess we still in some markets haven't seen as much as I would have expected would be challenge banks or neobanks. Okay. We have one or two in South Africa, which have done incredibly well, despite it being a hyper competitive environment with some
time.
Time Bank here, I think, has done an incredible job. Nigeria, you've got two very different directions from people who've come in. One is obviously more of a credit-led approach, like Fair Money, and then you have Kuda Bank that started with transactional banking. Kenya, there's Fingo in terms of partnering with a large bank. But I guess the reality of M-Pesa has just meant that is there a need for it? And maybe there isn't, right? People just already have this easy ability of moving money around. But I would have expected more. I didn't expect it to be such a thin ecosystem of neobanks or challenger banks.
Maybe it is that the cost to acquire those customers is extremely hard and the LTV is super low.
So. No, exactly. It's similar to you guys, where B2B has definitely been a favored category when it comes to venture investing. B2C is difficult. Changing behavior is hard. Building a brand of trust, especially in financial services, is really difficult. It's expensive, so you need to raise lots of money. The regulatory oversight very often is incredibly heavy because regulators are there to protect consumers. So yes, there probably is good reason, but I still would have expected more.
When you speak to your LPs, are you telling the story of emerging market giants? Are they going to be Pan-African multi-billion dollar outcomes, or are you aiming for lower? Because at Relicap, we have it comfortable. We say, hey, we get in at a 4 or 5 million valuation. Yeah. We get out at 120. Yeah. If there is an acquisition, we're happy. But I'm guessing for Kona, $150 million acquisition is not enough. So do you still need to push for the big story? And despite what happened at growth stage, do you still believe the dream is alive?
Yeah, I still believe it's alive. Absolutely. I think great founders, great entrepreneurs will figure it out. It is harder because if you need to go live in 6 or 7 countries, then it's just choosing what kind of business you back that can do that. Pure software, absolutely they can. If you're required to build a branch infrastructure, it's a very different story. That's MFI-esque or bank-esque, and that's just far harder. I think it's going to be that fintech 3.0 category I mentioned earlier, where you're building infrastructure that's far easier to replicate and go live in new markets, where you're leveraging local licenses and balance sheets.
One last question. We always talk about how emerging market founders are built different. They have that DNA. They're hustlers. They're astute. They're resilient. They're resourceful. Yeah. Do you have stories about founders who are like, whoa, this guy doesn't give up?
Some of the stories I've heard are crazy. There's one, you guys weren't invested. It was a personal investment I made where a founder had enough money to pay for AWS that month or to have a tooth extracted. He had to go to the dentist. He chose to drink a lot of whiskey and had a friend pull it out for him. to the point of going, he'd rather keep the service running and sacrifice his personal well-being. And you hear those stories and think, that's just crazy, right? It's outrageous. On the other side, we've seen founders who have raised a significant amount of money and they still have in their DNA this drive and this resolve to not get comfortable. And they will still, when they arrive in Cape Town, in this instance, phone and say, do you have a couch I can sleep on? So you just raised a huge round. You could stay anywhere you want, right? But I think those are the kind of founders who, it's almost the ones who have a chip on their shoulder and these founding teams where they go, I've got something to prove. To prove in the business world or to family, friends, I'm not sure what it is. It's the founders who are out there saying, I'm building this for more than just money or fame. And it's that continuous resolve that no matter how comfortable they could be if they chose to be, they will choose not to be. The other one that, and I'd actually love to get your views here, that I've seen and observed is it's harder being a solo founder, especially as it scales. We've had a number of conversations as well around the evolution of the founder role. And it's a hard conversation to have, especially when you're even just talking to an early stage founder who says, I'm actually planning on stepping out. What does that mean? But at the same time, it's very unusual to have a founder who will go from early stage concept all the way through to an IPO. And it's going to be interesting tracking that in Africa over the next 10 or 15 years of understanding what does that look like and how do you augment their ability by helping them build a really good team? How do you help them find co-founders even though they might have been running for a year or two? How do you help them with coaching, et cetera, et cetera? I've been so inspired by many of the founders where even when times are really tough, people have just managed to dust themselves off and carry on. Not everyone should be a founder. I do think when there was too much money in the market, there were too many people who had this glamorized view of what a founder is. And I think now I'm excited for next year and the year after, where we now are just, it's a bit of a reset. I think a lot of people who maybe shouldn't have been founders are not going to be founders anymore or won't consider leaving a comfortable job. And I think there's less money in the market, which is a good thing, where certain categories won't be hugely overinflated, where you're having venture dollars competing against each other.
Yeah.
In addition to that, the final one, it's going to be interesting to see the number of repeat founders in the market in the next couple of years. We've already seen some successful businesses where as the management teams are stepping out, they now have new relationships. They have a new perspective. They have a new understanding of venture and how it works. And I'm excited for that next wave of founders coming through who hit the ground running far faster than maybe the initial founder of that company would.
That's exactly what we tell LPs. It's right. Good. We should bring it to our LP conversations.
Exactly.
Preaching to the choir.
That's great.
That's awesome. Thank you for sitting, man. And
no problem.
Always
no problem.
Learning from you every time we sit down. So
no, look, we're a big fan of RallyCap and very often look at businesses that you guys have invested in and go, wow, if we could go earlier, we would have done that deal as well. So big fan of RallyCap and what you guys do.
Thanks for doing
awesome.
This.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
That was great.